You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us. On today's podcast, we're going to talk about permaculture for preparedness. And we're going to get into that and why I believe that permaculture is an excellent way. If you are a preparedness-minded person, you should embrace permaculture. It's a great way to impact your level of preparedness. And I also want to, we'll talk about some other issues. For example, what is a prepper and what does it mean to be preparedness-minded, and why is there a negative connotation with the word prepper, etc. But first, I want to talk to you about a worldview issue that just occurred. There's a lot of confusion for people that are not familiar with the Presbyterian Church. There's lots of denominations inside of Presbyterianism. So you have the Presbyterian Church USA, you have the PCA, or the Presbyterian Church of America, you have the OPC, the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, etc., etc. There's the RPC and several others that are maybe smaller denominations, have less presbyteries. But the Presbyterian Church USA votes to recognize same-sex marriage. Now, they were already down this road, and there's a very important point here. Well, let me just read you a couple of sentences out of this article from Time magazine. It says that the Presbyterian Church USA made a historic decision Tuesday night to formally recognize gay marriage and allow same-sex couples to marry in its congregations. And I'm going to skip down here. A presbytery is a governing body, if you will, made up of sessions or individual churches. Okay, and the presbytery, which is, you know, may have dozens of sessions underneath of it, reports to a general assembly and everything like that. So Presbyterianism is a form of government. That's really what that word means. And it would be very similar to our representative style government of the United States. Okay, so you have individual sessions, which, and you have presbyteries, and you have a general assembly. Now, again, some Presbyterian denominations run a little bit differently, but that's the general idea. And I want to highlight here, because this PCUSA is very much the liberal end of Presbyterianism in the United States. There were 87 presbyteries that voted in favor of this decision, and 41 presbyteries who voted against. So there's still lots of disagreement, even in their own denomination. But what's important to understand here is to look at the history of the PCUSA. The bottom line is this. There's been an historic trend of biblical compromises in the PCUSA. So this is no surprise. This surprised nobody who's been watching this. It was a foregone conclusion. They've been making compromises for a very long time. In fact, if we look at just a little bit of history, we see that the OPC, or the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, and consider that more conservative end of Presbyterianism, not the most conservative, but definitely all the, you know, down towards that end. Well, they're a group of these men in the 1930s broke away from the PCUSA to form the Orthodox Presbyterian Church because they objected to the pervasive theological differences that were prevalent in the 1930s. Okay, so this started a long time ago. So the point that I'm getting to right now with this entire subject is not about gay marriage. It is about compromising on the Word of God, or how you view the Scriptures. Okay, so we see that the PCUSA, and I'm sorry, has a very low view of Scripture, and that's just the truth. They won't look at it. They will ignore portions of it. They will interpret it very, very loosely, and essentially their view of it is a low view. Somebody with a high view would regard it as reverent, super important, a to be followed, etc. Okay, so I don't mean that they don't have any love for the Scriptures or anything like that, but they're much like the modern evangelical church. There's a lot of inconsistency. Let's put it that way. So, like, I'm going to give you an example with the PCUSA. Long time ago, and I don't know when. It's not that important. They came to the conclusions that women could become preachers, essentially. Okay, they could become ministers. All right, now whether anyone likes that or not, whether anyone thinks that's sexist or not, that's the teaching of the Bible. So if you take the Bible at its word, if you say that this is for faith, life, and practice, then we need to come to that conclusion. And it says clearly in the Bible that it leaves that role to men. Period. Now, does that mean that women are less than men? Of course not. Absolutely not. The Bible is very clear on that as well. But I believe the Bible teaches a complementary position. We have our roles and responsibilities. There is no, men are not better than women. They are not held in higher esteem than women. They are not held to a higher position in the eyes of God than women. But we have complementary roles, and that was part of God's design. So, that's the biblical teaching. Now, you may not like it. You may say, I don't believe the Bible. Well, then, okay, you're not going to come to that conclusion. But you see my point. If somebody who claims to be a Christian, claims to have the Bible as their axiom for faith, life, and practice, then they're not going to compromise on those types of issues. And if they do, then it's natural that it follows that they will continue to compromise. So that's my point with the PCUSA. They compromised way back when, and that trend has continued. That is not to say that every person that is in the PCUSA is somehow a less than Christian or they are compromisers. I'm not saying that. I'm saying as a denomination, it's very clear that they have compromised. Okay, enough of that. The other point besides that we have to take the Scripture as our starting point, and it needs to be our rule of faith, life, and practice, or our, you would call it an ultimate authority. We have to have that to determine right or wrong and to wrestle with these theological issues. It's important. But the other thing that we see with the PCUSA, and like I said, they compromised a long time ago, is that they have, and I've talked about this many times before, that people are carried along by the culture, and specifically the church. If it's not rooted in the Word of God, it will also be carried along by the culture. And that's what we see with the PCUSA. 30, 40, 50 years ago, even when the PCUSA or other denominations, doesn't matter, were compromising on the Word of God, they still would have not have affirmed gay marriage. Of course not. But then again, the culture wasn't demanding that of them. See what I'm saying? So it's important that we not be carried along by the culture, that we have an ultimate authority, and that the Scriptures are our rule for faith, life, and practice, even though many things are hard to wrestle with, and we will not get it perfect by any means, but that has to be our starting point. Okay, let's get into the main topic for today. And I kind of titled it Permaculture for Preparedness. And I want to get into that because I don't think there's a better system out there for preparedness. Okay, but first let's talk about what it means. What is preparedness? Because a lot of people, they will get freaked out by that term. for some reason, because that's how it's been painted, but especially the term prepper. If you hear the term prepper, what immediately comes to your mind? Well, the way the media has painted it, what's going to come to mind is the guy with the gas mask and all the cases of MREs in his, you know, his bomb shelter. Okay, it's doomsday preppers. That's what comes to mind. That is not, I mean, that's certainly what some preppers are. But that is certainly not all preppers. And that certainly is not what is meant when somebody uses the term preparedness. Preparedness simply means to be ready, okay? To prepare for whatever it is. And so, you know, somebody who's preparedness minded might be like, "Oh yeah, I'm preparedness minded. I've trained and drilled my family on fire drills in the home. I've trained and drilled my family with regards to tornadoes, because we live in an area that tornadoes hit every year. And so we bought a house with a basement, or we have, you know, a storm shelter, whatever." That would be somebody who is preparedness-minded. That preparedness-minded person might also think that something like financial collapse is going to occur, so they're good with their money, they diversify their assets. They're not all in paper assets. They've got a bit of food storage, and I mean, this is the way people just used to live. I mean, what we should be is mocking the person that doesn't prepare. Okay, but instead we mock the person that prepares. All right, so the prepper has gotten a bad rap or a negative connotation based on the fact that the media has spun it that way. Okay. You want preparedness-minded people in your community. You want them in your family. Hopefully, you want that for yourself, because those are the people that are going to be able to help others during calamity. Okay, if you are unprepared, you are going to be the one asking for help in a disaster. If you care about helping others, if you want to help your family, your friends, your community, then you should be prepared. Okay, but there's a lot of issues facing us today. I think you'd have to be asleep or blind to not realize that we live in precarious times. I don't know if anything's going to happen. Nothing might happen. Now, I don't believe that. I just can't prove that it's going to happen, or I can't prove that on any particular timeline. I have no idea. Okay, and I don't claim to be an expert in things like food security or water security or financial security, in those types of issues that we face in today's world. But I want to take a stab at those for a minute. Let's look at, and we can look at it together. Look at food security and water security. Okay, so a preparedness-minded person might think, okay, there's definitely some issues here. If nothing else, man, these things are getting a little bit more scarce, or they're getting a little bit more expensive. I don't know if you've noticed, but if you buy simple vegetables in the store, it's getting expensive. Even though we have no inflation, of course, you know, according to government statistics, we have no inflation, but food is getting a lot more expensive. Okay, that should be clear to anyone who regularly shops for food, or you know, you probably have noticed. There's no doubt. It's definitely getting more expensive. Now let's look at the case of California. Now a lot of people are saying this is all hyped up or anything else, but I want to give you some considerations here. Okay, California, very clearly, no one doubts this, is in a massive drought. Okay, for several years, since 2011, they've had significantly less water than their averages. And of course, that's what determines what a drought is if it's below a certain percentage of that area's norm. Okay, so in a place like Yuma, Arizona, that gets 4 inches a year, if it rains 6 inches, well, they're doing great. Okay, they're not in drought, because that's normal for that area. That's above normal for that area. Well, in all of California, they're in extreme drought right now. Most of California is in either moderate to extreme drought. Okay. Now you see all these articles going around here lately about, hey, they've got 1 year of water left. Well, what does that mean? I think that it means is that they have one more year of water left to sustain the level of agriculture that they're known for, or at least within some margin of error. Okay, but here's the deal. They're not producing as much food as they used to already. It's been in decline since 2011. This is a known fact. Just look this up. Start doing a little bit of research for yourself, and you will see that there's been orchards that have been leveled. There's been entire areas that have basically said, okay, it's no longer viable to farm here. It costs too much money, you know, to continue to pipe the water. All their aquifers are going down. The amount of water that they can pipe over is diminishing as well. Okay, so there's a problem there. There's a big problem there. And yet, you know, it's amazing to me that you still don't see rainwater collection on every single house in California. I don't understand it. If you go to somewhere like Japan, or you see it in Australia a lot, places like that, everybody collects water. I mean, who doesn't collect rainwater? I mean, that's foolishness. You know, to put that type of to have that kind of a system that's precarious like that, and not do simple things like that. Now, a lot of people will immediately say, you're a fear-mongerer. You have an entire ocean next to you, and you can just, you know, you build desalinization plants and you, yada, yada, yada. Okay, yep, you can do that. You can spend billions of dollars building desalinization plants. You can take in tons of seawater, and they're doing that. They're building one right near San Diego. But it will not even, that one plant will not even supply the needs for San Diego. But when you take in, let's say, use the example of 100 gallons of seawater to get 50 gallons of clean drinking water, potable water, okay? Now, the 50 gallons of seawater that goes back into the ocean, because that's where it's going to be pumped, has a radically increased salinity, okay? So all that salt is being concentrated and then going back into the ocean. Now, I don't know what kind of impact that will have. I really don't know. I don't, and I'm not going to make any speculation on that. That's going to ruin the ocean or anything. I don't think that it would. But here is a consideration. It takes a massive amount of energy to make clean water from salt water. Okay, and that, what is that predicated on? That's predicated on our supply line systems with regards to energy. Okay, so we have, you see this kind of thing together. It's taking us a system that is precarious, that is under major stress. I'm talking about California as a whole here with their water and et cetera. So it's under stress. And so what do? We put it into a more precarious position. We say, okay, we'll desalinate the sea, but we'll need massive amounts of energy to do that. Okay. The bottom line is that is an entirely precarious system. All right. And we should not, as a preparedness-minded person, we need to look at that and go, okay, that system is fragile. Let me put in some safeties in place to mitigate that risk. All right, if I lived in Southern California, I'd be like, hey, right on, you want to build some desalinization plants? Good. Guess what? I'm building some rainwater catchment in my backyard. And I'm gonna set up a gray water system so I can reduce the amount of water I'm using. You know, that kind of thing. But a lot of people aren't doing that because they're just saying, hey, then, you know, these guys are all going to figure it out and they're going to get us the water we need. Okay, so you have that. That is one example. Food security. Our food that's produced in the United States is, again, it's built on massive energy inputs. It's built on trucking. It's built on the presumption of cheap oil. It's built on massive chemical fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides, etc., which, again, is all based, all oil-based. So what I'm saying to you is this. That system is fragile. We're no longer in a position where we have oil bubbling out of the ground. I'm not saying that we're going to run out of oil. I'm not at all. But what I am saying is that eventually the true price, the real unmanipulated price of oil is going to come to bear. Okay, I don't think we're going to run out of oil anytime soon at all. But do I think oil will get more expensive? Yes. Once the manipulators are no longer able to manipulate, we will have increased costs for oil. And as the petrodollar continues to lose its prominence, we will have increased costs for oil, which means gas, which means food, etc. It's all connected. So, with that being said, a prudent man would take precaution. Okay, a prudent man would see danger and act. Okay, I think it is a wise thing to do, to be prepared. So that kind of leads me into permaculture. And permaculture, I'm going to talk to, is a little bit different than say doing your food storage and water storage. And then there's nothing wrong with those things. They're perfectly good things. Again, that's how people just used to live life. I think that we should get back to that. Because again, what do you have when a family, when a community is filled with people who are interdependent, somewhat self-sufficient, resilient, they've got some storage. They've got their larder, you know, again, it was perfect. That was a normal thing. In fact, it was irregular for someone not to have some stores. Then when calamity strikes or there's a large storm that impacts the area, people do well. They do okay. They help each other out. They make sure that, you know, any of those that were directly affected, and maybe their entire home was destroyed, and there goes their stores and their larder. People help them out. Their neighbors, their community, their churches would be able to help them out. That's what we need to get back to. So again, it's not that I think food storage or, you know, worrying about your communications and your security, all very important things. What I want to talk about today is permaculture for preparedness. This, to me, is the best system out there. When we look at all of these variables that kind of are converging, if you will, or at least that there's potential, there's certainly, I didn't even touch on the financial aspect of it. All these things should make us think about these things. What permaculture does is permaculture, and again, is a design system that aims to create abundance. It's something that looks at our systems, our food systems, our energy, our water, our waste, our structures, and says, okay, how can we have all these things work together more efficiently and more sustainably? Okay, that's really what it is. And I know for a lot of people, sustainability or is one of those words that's, you know, they don't like it because it's associated with you know, hippies and earth worshipers and liberals. Sustainability is simply the ability of a system to continue to exist and survive without lots of external inputs. Okay, nobody should be looking down on the word sustainability. I know it's used and probably overused in many ways. Everybody wants to be sustainable now. Even if they're not sustainable, they're sustainable. I'm talking about systems that actually are sustainable. So food systems, animal systems, water systems that can replenish themselves and keep going. What does that do? That allows you to survive, to be resilient, to be self-sufficient. Okay, and that's what permaculture is all about. And I'll use the example. There's I took Jeff Lawton's permaculture design course, very eye-opening, excellent course that really taught me all these principles, and it's gotten me to the point where I can actually go and help people design their properties, which I've been doing, and I'm doing it with my own property. So I'm putting all these things into practice. I'm practicing what I'm preaching here, not imperfectly, making mistakes all the time, but learning from them. So I want to use this example. Jeff Lawton visited an oasis in the Moroccan desert. This place was really a remnant of an ancient sustainable agriculture. Okay, again, not sustainable as in, you know, that you have an organic symbol over there, or, you know, people don't wear shoes. This is where this system continued to produce food in the desert without tons of inputs based on oil or heavy machinery or et cetera. I mean, for 2,000 years, this area continued to produce food. And in fact, even today, and again, this is in Morocco, 800 people live in this area. It's like a little oasis surrounded by desert. Okay, but this place has continued to produce food for centuries, literally, for millennia. The main overstory of this place, or the main high trees, are date palms. Okay, and the understory, or the things that grow underneath that overstory, are carob, bananas, olives, figs, pomegranates, guava, citrus, mulberries, grapes, and more. And this is a system that continues to produce food, continues to reproduce itself, and they're not bringing in their soil from Walmart and their chemical fertilizers. No, it's existing on its own. This is the essence of permaculture. Not that permaculture didn't even exist back then. But it's the idea that a system that works together, it's sustainable, it's interlinked, it's synergistic, all working together. This is what we can achieve on an individual level, and even on a scale. So if it doesn't matter if you have a tiny little postage stamp of a lawn, there's stuff you can do. Or if you've got 40 acres in lush farmland, or if you're in semi-arid or even an arid type environment, there's a lot you can do. If these peoples can do it in the Moroccan desert, or another example is Jeff Lawton did not an education site, but a proof of concept area or a test site in Jordan, like 2 miles maybe north of the Dead Sea. This is like super arid. I mean, really dry country. 400 feet below sea level, super hot. Nothing's growing down. Nothing is growing here. A little bit of scrub here and there. They went out there and tried to put in these permaculture principles into practice and did a test site. If you're interested in that, take a look. Google Greening the Desert. By Jeff Lawton. It's amazing what was done there. Now, so this was over like a 10-year period or something like that, and they did amazing work there. It transformed that little 10-acre test site. Okay, it shows you what you can do in the worst of places. So none of us have anything to complain about because it can be done in the vast majority of places where we are. So permaculture for preparedness. What better way to be prepared for all the things I listed before, financial, crisis, water, food, etc., than to be able to reap a lot of your own food. And more importantly than that, and I, in fact, last podcast I talked about this, perennials versus annuals, and the fact that we are doing an annual garden. And we will continue to do that because we like those vegetables. But we're also putting in a lot of perennial systems for this reason. Not for just preparedness purposes. Because I don't want to work that hard, quite honestly. And so we are planting a food forest like the one in Morocco. Totally different species, smaller scale. But we're doing that here on our property. And I would love to be able to achieve that type of sustainability. Okay, when everything kind of works together, it just continues, just like the forest continues without you, without your intervention, unless there's, you know, forest fire or massive disease that comes through would be the couple of exceptions to that. But these systems are set up to work synergistically. And guess what? If I've got a food forest going that's all perennial, do I have to save seeds? No, I do not. Do I have to go to Walmart and to get my nitrogen fertilizers and my Miracle-Gro and my soil? And no, I don't. Okay, because that system is producing its own mulch. It's got different species in there that are working together. And I'm going to talk about some of those. So permaculture for preparedness makes complete sense, people. It really does. Perennial systems, they're in place, they're growing. And even for the hardcore preppers out there, the ones who have retreat properties, they've got their mountain property. There's a tiny little cabin up there, and they call it a quote-unquote hunting property. But they know because they've got caches dug up there and buried, and they've got food storage and water storage. And when it hits the fan, that's where they're going. They got a plan. They got a bug-out plan. That's where they're I mean, even for that person, plant you a food forest up there. You don't even need to be there. This is a beautiful thing. Now, you may say, well, you got to tend this thing. You got to water it, right, and all this. No, you don't. Once these systems are established, you do not need to do that. Okay, you need to set up the main frame work, and that may require some earthworks. Okay, and whether it's dug by hand or while you can use machinery, that's fine. So you're digging earthworks to help establish the system. And then what I would do is if your goal was like, yeah, I want to have a fruit and nut orchard, and I want some support species that I can cut down every 7 years and pollard down and use that for fuel. And so I have all my fuel wood up there, and I've got fruits and nuts, and that's going to really help sustain me. You're right, it will. And that's a good plan. But what I would do if I had a little property that I was going to, a little hunting property, is I would buy bare root trees cheaply. Because if you buy, you know, your big box store $25, $30 trees, you're going to go broke. And I'd go up and I would way overplant. I would put in these earthworks. I don't care if you do it by hand. Maybe it's just a small swale that, you know, that there's some water catchment that'll come in, it'll soak in, it'll keep the area moist, and I would way overplant that area. If you wanted to say you wanted fruits, nuts, and support species, so you did a fruit, a nut, a support species, a fruit, a nut, and a support species, down this long line down the swale, and you planted 100 of these bare root trees that, believe it or not, won't cost a whole lot of money. It'll cost you a few hundred dollars, but that's not a lot of money when you think about it. And when you go up there two, three times a year, maybe when you make an initial plan, you go up there, you put everything in the ground, and you're going to stay up there for a week, and you get a chance to water for a week. And then you walk away, and then you go into using the stun method, sheer total utter neglect. Okay. And that's what you do. And guess what? You come back 6 months later and you go, okay, I had, 30% of these died right off the bat. All right, they're gone. No big deal. And And then you come back the next time and you're like, man, 25% more died. And you cut those out and they're done. Well, guess what? Guess what you got left? You got left, you know, lots of trees. I don't even care. Let's say you were down all the way down to 20 trees. Because you will have some. I guarantee it. You will have some. Out of those 20 trees that are left, guess what they are? They thrive with sheer total utter neglect. You see what you did? Now, if you put all your eggs and said, okay, I'm going to buy these three fruit trees that are $40 a piece or whatever, and at the big box store, and you put them in and you come back and all three of them are dead. Well, should have expected that. There's actually a better chance for those younger trees to do well than for an established, say, two-year-old tree to go in there. All right, so I think it blows my mind that everyone with a retreat property doesn't do this. I am blown away. This is the simplest thing. Why don't you go plant trees up there? Productive trees. You know, you got to do a little bit of work up front, and maybe, like I said, maybe you have to stay up there for a little while. Hopefully you want to do that anyway. You can put perennial systems in an area that you're not living. I don't understand why people don't do this. That's why I tell everyone, it's like, what, do you got any trees up there? Have you planted anything? And they're like, no, you know, I've got food storage. I've got water storage. Okay, good. But go plant some trees. You know, you want long-term viability. You want a 2,000-year-old food forest that survived how many governments? A lot of governments. Okay, so permaculture for preparedness makes complete sense. It also does things like makes you think about water usage, for example. Okay, it's permaculture is a different way of thinking. It doesn't chop everything up into like, okay, here's my water. I get my water from the faucet. I pay the utility company, you know, whatever. Here's my little garden here. That's this other thing. Here's my furnace over here that I push the button and the heat comes on. It's thinking about all these systems together. It's like, okay, but water, yes. I'm going to use water. I have one source of water, and that's from the utility company. Great. I turn the faucet on, water comes out. Awesome. Okay, what's my backup system? I don't have one. Well, you should. Okay, my backup system is I filled six, you know, old 2-liter bottles of Coke filled with water. Okay, good. What else? This is permaculture thinking. What else? What else? What about using the water that you get from your sinks and setting up a gray water system where you can put that out into the garden? You know, if you have those systems in place and all of a sudden water rationing comes up, it's not really that big of a deal for you, okay? Or why don't I collect rainwater? I've got all this square footage of roof, and I've got all this water that, you know, the system currently set up to get it off my property as fast as possible, put it into the drains, and rush it off, get it out of the community, instead of slowing, spreading, and soaking it. You ever notice in a very dry environment, you get massive amounts of rain, and you know, and within just like 2 days or 3 days, if it doesn't rain again, it's totally dry. It's because the soil, the ground was never able to soak that up. Okay, and that's why one of the principles is slow spread and soak water. Okay, and I would think of it as this: permaculture for preparedness. Yes, we want to slow spread and soak. And yes, we want to come up with primary, secondary, and tertiary means of water. Okay, that to me is perfectly complementary. It's permaculture, it's preparedness. And I want to set up systems that don't need a lot of water. I use the example again of Jeff Lott, when he did Greening the Desert, and they went into Jordan and established this food forest. And they used 20% of the water that would normally be used using conventional methods. 20%. Okay, that's super important in a country like Jordan. And if you can look this up, these people have their water situation is absolutely terrible. It's terrible all the time, let alone now.
But
you can look at it that way and determine that, hey, this is a great system. It uses much less water, which is good because I no longer have the luxury of the utilities pumping me water. Okay. If you already had a rainwater catchment system set up, if you already had ways that water was slowed and spread and soaked into your soil, you don't need as much water anyway. Okay, a lot of that rainwater catchment can be for drinking and washing, and maybe some of it's going to your crops. Another thing to think about, if you're the type of person, and again, nothing wrong with this, I've had one. You have one of these, you know, seed banks. You're like, hey, yeah, I'm going to get this, you know, this tin can filled with a bunch of seeds, and break in case of emergency, right? That's your plan. That if something bad happens, well, I'll plant a garden and then I will live. That is a terrible plan. That is a terrible plan. First of all, you have to ensure that those seeds are viable. So if you're storing seeds, depending on how you store them, for long periods of time, there's a chance that a lot of them will not germinate. Some of them probably will. And you know, it depends on the type of seed you're talking about, but that's not a good plan. Okay, hopefully you're growing food now at least. If you're growing some of your own food and you're kind of stuck in the whole perennial cycle, then hopefully you're doing that. You're growing food and you're learning how to save seed, because guess what? If you're planning on annuals to save you, you got to save seed every year. All right, that's why perennial systems are better. And again, you don't get rid of your annuals. Just make that your annuals a supplement to your perennial systems. And that, again, that's a shift in mindset. What we do is in the United States, is we're annual. We our staples are annuals, and we supplement that with perennials. Okay, we need to flip that. We'd be better off as a nation, first of all, and secondly, you as an individual or family or community, I would do very well by that. You want to be a great neighbor. You live in a neighborhood. Buy all of your neighbors a couple fruit trees. So, hey, I got something for you. Give everyone in your neighborhood a couple of, make sure that they, you know, they'll pollinate and spread them out. Say, oh, I'm going to give, you know what? I see that Bob likes cherries. I'm going to buy him a couple of young cherry trees. And I see that Susie over there, she likes apples. So I'm going to buy her a couple of apple trees. You see how that could go if that's a place that you plan on living for a long time? That if times get tough and all of a sudden, what do you have? You have all these fruit trees in the neighborhood. People are sharing with each other, helping each other out. You're building community this way. You're building resilience, not only in your own life, but that in the community as well. So that would be like, I don't know, to me, permaculture style thinking on a little bit larger scale in your community. Especially for the preparedness-minded. It's not just about, oh, I'm going to be a nice person. Hopefully you're doing that to be nice and to help your neighbor out. But it also makes your neighborhood, your community, more resilient. And if everybody had, you know, just a handful, three or four fruit or nut trees in their yards, wow, that neighborhood would be much better off. Here's another thing with regards to permaculture and preparedness. It's not just the perennial versus the annual. It's not just the water collection. Again, it's the inter-use of all those systems. The main benefit to employing permaculture for preparedness is your way of thinking. So it's integrating all the elements. Okay, it's like, how are you going to, I mean, just think, I want to lay out a terrible scenario. Okay, you know, not the zombie apocalypse, But the scenario, for whatever reason, that causes either the grid to go down or oil to go up exponentially. I don't care. I mean, you pick your terrible scenario. If it was a grid down situation due to a solar flare like the Carrington event of 1895, that would cause major disruption. And it might even cause major disruption for long periods of time in many areas. That would be hard. And if you were in a system, let's say you're on a hobby farm. I mean, I'm still in this situation myself, and I'm working hard to get myself out of it. And I'll cover that here in just a minute. But if you were in a situation where the grid went down and, you know, trucking essentially stopped, or it was slowed to a crawl because of just the system is overwhelmed, because the system is not resilient at all. It's not. I mean, just look at a simple storm that flows through, whether it's Hurricane Sandy or Hurricane Katrina. I'm not saying those are simple storms that were devastating, but look at the tiny percentage of the country that it hit, and look at the impact that it had, and look at our inability to respond. Okay, and everybody was looking for what? The government to respond, right? And they were slow to do it, and of course, they can't respond to everything. So you do have some livestock, you do have some plantings, and all of a sudden you don't have any water. Or you have so little water that the only thing you can do is use it for drinking water. You have no ability to go buy grain to feed your animals. You have no ability to get hay. This kind of thing. Your systems would break down very quickly, and so would mine in many respects even now. But again, we're working towards more and more to build systems that are sustainable. So I'll give you the example. I'll give you my situation right now, because part of this is demonstration. I do permaculture for a living, or that's part of what I do, sustainable. And quite frankly, I want to set up a system so I don't have to work so hard, and will produce abundantly in food. I mean, that's just the truth. But right now, I'm not fully there, not at all. We have a system where we have to bring in grain. We have to bring in hay. But we are working on building more sustainable systems. So what do I mean by that? Well, I'm trying to improve my pasture land. So I'm trying to increase the fertility of that land so that it produces better hay that's higher quality, that's got more minerals that the animals can eat, and they'll need less of it. Because when you have junk hay, they have to eat a lot of it to get anything out of it. I'm working on expanding the areas where animals can go. I'm looking at running pigs through the forest in a sustainable way. So I'm moving them. I don't want them to destroy it. I want them to disturb an area, work it for a while, and then move. Okay, and then the hope there is that my pasture gets better, my forest become more fertile, and start producing. Okay, that's a sustainable system, but truth be told, if the Schumer hit the fan right now, I would have to cool down what I have in order to be sustainable. I do have an amount that would be sustainable here, but it's not what I have. Now, in the spring, summer, and fall, my land could easily support the animals that I have. Okay, and then, like I said, over time, if that land becomes more fertile and more nutrient rich, then I may be able to support the amount of animals I have right now year round, in that I would have to cut my own hay, etc. All right. Now think about this. Could I don't have a tractor, so I'm not cutting hay with a tractor. All right. There are people even today that with small scale homesteads that scythe their own hay, and you know they enjoy it because it's It's what they like to do. It's their form of exercise. Doesn't mean that they don't, you know, they like to say, hey, you can never use a tractor or anything like that. It's just that's what they choose to do. So if it really came down to it, I could do that. But right now, based on the fertility of my land, I would have to scale down the amount of animals that I have. Okay, so that these are all things that you have to think about. So now's the time. Not, oh, okay, that if something happens, then here's my plan. I'm going to go plant some fruit and nut trees. No, it's too late. Fruit and nut trees would take anywhere from, and bushes and et cetera, anywhere from a couple years all the way up to 7 years or more, depending on certain types of nuts, to start bearing fruit or nuts. You need to plant those systems now. Now, here's the good news is there are some shrubs and bushes and vines and those things that will produce very fast. And they're perennial and they'll continue to be around. So you need to do a mix. So what I would do, if I was a preparedness-minded individual and I had any bit of land that I was living on, or if I had a retreat property, then I would ultimately want to go plant a food forest. That's what I would do. I think that's the single best thing you can do as a preparedness-minded individual in this realm, okay, as far as food production is concerned. I'm not talking about if you're nowhere near being able to be on your own land. If you're overseas, for example, the best thing you can do is you know, establish yourself financially, diversify your assets, make sure you have a good family plan, a good communication plan, etc. You know, those are the first steps. You want to make sure that you have a good fire plan for your house before you start worrying about a food forest. All right, but I'm assuming that who I'm talking to right now has at least something that they can plant or somewhere. Maybe it's on the family farm back somewhere, and you go out and go, hey guys, let me have this acre over here. Let me do an experiment. I'm going to plant this food forest, and we're going to establish it. This is what I would do if you had the opportunity. Now, again, it's a little bit different if you have a retreat property, and I would still do it, and I would go up there, and I would way overplant tons of productive and support species trees and plants. I'd go up there, and I'd water it for a week, and I'd walk away, and I'd go, okay, we'll see what's alive in 6 months when I come back. And if only 10 or 20% of it is alive, I'll cut everything else out. It becomes mulch. And then that 10% is doing pretty well. And that now to try it again and maybe get those numbers up even more. That's what I would do. But if I was in an area where I could tend to it, I would put animals in. And if I had to, I'd borrow animals over the area that you wanted to establish a food forest. I don't care if it's chickens or goats. Both good candidates. I would run them over that ground, let them tear it up. Even better, run some goats through there and then some chickens through there. Or pigs and chickens or whatever. Don't over disturb it, but don't under disturb it. Let them go through there. Let them pick out the weeds and the vegetation and dig things up and do a little bit of tilling for you. You're not turning over the soil. They're just scratching it up. Once that was done, I'd put in something like a cover crop for productive trees, etc. Because, again, that's the goal, is that it becomes a food forest. Okay, so your cover crops like peas or beans or lentils or clovers, all right, these are legumes, and they're nitrogen-fixing plants. They're really prepping that area for these productive trees, productive and support trees. You can also use things like that are high in carbon, like rye, oats, wheat, barley. Again, there's a theme here that all these can be used to some degree and in some ways. All right, once that cover crop was established, and then I would look to be putting in my productive trees. So again, fruit, nut, and support, and I would overplant the area. I would totally overplant it with trees, and that's why one of the advantages of using your bare root trees, because you can buy them in bulk and you can buy a whole lot more of them. It's cheaper that way than buying these established, you know, 1 or 2 year old trees. That gets very pricey. It's hard to do that if you're going to go that route. And I'd put in a mix. I wouldn't, you know, put in like all apples. I'm going to put in all, you know, Fuji apples. I wouldn't do that. I would put in a diverse array of trees, fruit, nut, and support. Okay, you don't just, a lot of people make the mistake of they just want to put in all fruit trees like it's a commercial orchard. You're probably going to have problems that way. Again, that's the diversity keeps everything in balance. You want to put in a mix of productive trees that will produce early, mid, and late season. That extends your period, your harvesting period, especially in as a preparedness-minded individual. If things are really bad, and you know, your preservation techniques are down to drying and you know, fermenting and things like this. Okay, in other words, you can't just freeze everything. I mean, that's, people talk about preserving food, they throw it in the freezer. Yes, that's a viable option. That shouldn't be your only one. And so I would do that. I would completely overplant the area, and then I would add things like comfrey and other, what they call dynamic accumulators. And what these types of plants do is they pull up nutrients deep and minerals deep from deep down and bring them up to the surface so that those productive trees can use them. The support species, like, say, for example, black locust, used in with your fruit and nut trees, fixed nitrogen. So not only are the clovers and the peas that kind of are growing underneath that are also keeping the weeds away, which compete with your productive trees. All those things are helping each other out, and they're creating a system that will eventually be in balance. You just gotta kind of let it go. It's not gonna look as tidy and clean as your normal orchard, but that's not the goal. The goal is a natural system that mimics natural systems, and that's also very productive. Okay, that's what I would do, and I'd overplant, and I would cull as necessary. I would, you know, if particular trees were not all, you know, after a year were not doing well or dying, they're gone. Okay. Let's start looking at the ones that are doing well. And, you know, those are going to be your productive trees down the road, and let this system establish itself. And, you know, while it's in its early years, in its infancy, while there's still a lot of sun that can get through because you don't have the canopy established, you can do other things like plant annual vegetables in and amongst them. But don't overtake that with annuals. Put some annuals in there. But you actually want things like a lot of comfrey in there, a lot of nitrogen fixing shrubs and like I said, trees. So to me, permaculture is the ultimate system for preparedness. I could go on and on here with water. Life force, if you will, right there. The way that permaculture looks at water is entirely different than we do commercially. And commercially, again, and even in our own yards, we want to get it off as fast as possible. Get it away. Get it out. And permaculture says, no, slow it, spread it, and soak it. The best place to store your water is in your soil, okay, because that ultimately brings you your productivity. But then, you know, obviously we need to have water to drink. We have to have water to bathe. We have to have water to cook. And so there's lots of systems with catchment type systems, whether it's in ponds or swales or we're developing springs and then gravity feeding or just collecting rainwater and then reusing that after we wash with it and bathe it with it. And so, yeah, we might not dump it directly on our annual vegetables, but we would certainly put it in the swale and let it soak into the soil to provide water for our food forest or whatever. Okay, so in this, the same thing with energy. Permaculture is constantly looking to create a system where the energy can be obtained right there, okay, from the land. I saw this awesome eggmobile, and again, this eggmobile was a group of chickens that were being moved from place to place. And again, what were they doing? They were prepping the area that would later become food forest. So they were working the ground and tilling it and scratching and being moved in this eggmobile. So the eggmobile, they go in at night, it gets closed up, and they're let out. So they might work a place for a week or whatever it is. I mean, it depends on the amount of birds, the size of the area, and the condition of the soil. But they're working this area, and when they're ready to move at night, everybody goes in, they lock them up, and then they move it, and then open it back up. And they've got their own electric netting, for example, which you may or may not have if the times get really bad. But this little contraption had a single solar panel on top, which powered the charger for the electric netting. Now, that's not a totally sustainable system. Eventually, that battery is going to fail and that netting. But the point is that it was a whole lot more sustainable than, you know, the alternative, which is our kind of traditional single element way of keeping an animal. We have our animals over here, and over there we will till the soil in order to plant it, etc. Instead, I'm going to use the animals to do that. All right, but this system where not only did this eggmobile have a panel on top and was able to contain and house the battery, which charged the small amount of netting, you know, that was maybe 40 feet square or something like that. But it also had a very small rainwater catchment system off of its roof, which supplied the water for the chickens. You see what I'm saying? That this is the mindset, the thinking that I'm talking about, that I really garnered from permaculture. And that's why I think it's so good for preparedness. That's how we need to think. And instead, a lot of times, the preparedness individual will simply go, okay, I need to store, you know, 1 gallon of water per day per person. That's the formula. So I will get 55-gallon drums, and I will, you know, no, let's think about a system that's actually sustainable. Go ahead, get your 55-gallon drums and do some of that. But how about let's set up a rainwater catchment system? How about let's set up a pond area? How about let's reuse our gray water so that water is being used 2, 3, 4 times in different ways? That's a sustainable system. Okay, I think I've rambled on for long enough. I really think that if anybody is very serious about prepping or preparedness, that permaculture should be a part of your plan. I really do. So make sure you let me know if you have any questions regarding this, any specific questions. All right. The verse for today comes from Proverbs chapter 22 in verse 3. It says, "The prudent sees danger and hides himself, but the simple go on and suffer for it." This concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening. Please visit us on our website, thecourageouslifepodcast.com. We'd appreciate any comments or questions that you have. And also like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast. Semper Fidelis and Sole Deo Gloria.